Hello, I'm James Kumarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 3rd of December, a night of political turmoil in South Korea, where the president has imposed, then lifted martial law after MPs voted to block him. We'll get the latest from the capital, Seoul, and try to find out what led to this and what comes next. In France, a slower-burning political drama is playing out ahead of tomorrow's expected no-confidence vote in Prime Minister Michel Barnier. We ask a former governor of the Bank of France how serious things are looking for the French economy. Fergal Keane reports on strains within the Israeli army. Tariq Ali recalls the night that Malcolm X came to the Oxford Union, and two of the top TikTok educators on using the app as a teaching aid. Some political crises burn slowly towards a conclusion. Others flare up out of nowhere. What's happened in South Korea over the past few hours certainly falls into the latter category. And it's been quite a ride for what we're used to seeing as a stable Western allied democracy with one of the world's strongest economies. It all began at 10:45 in the evening local time when President Yoon Suk-yeol used a surprise television appearance to deliver an unexpected message.
Dear citizens, I hereby declare martial law to protect the Republic of Korea from the threats posed by North Korean communist forces and to eradicate in one sweep the shameless pro-North, anti-state forces that are plundering the freedom and happiness of our people.
Soon afterwards, the focus switched to the seat of parliament, the National Assembly, which is dominated by the president's political opponents. As military helicopters hovered overhead, a large number of protesters gathered on the ground. Their chant was "Abolish martial law," a message that was heard loud and clear inside the building, where almost two-thirds of the 300 assembly members, including some members of the president's own party, had gathered in an emergency session, many of them very determined to get there. Hong Ki-won is with the main opposition Democratic Party. At just after 2 a.m. his time, he told my colleague Tim Franks how he'd reacted to the president's declaration of martial law.
At the time, I was sleeping at home, and then my wife woke me up and then informed me that the president declared the state of emergency. My first thought was that it is not real. It is not possible. I just left my house heading to the National Assembly in Seoul.
And how easy was it to get into the parliament?
Not easy. Very difficult. When I arrived at the gate of the National Assembly, the door was closed, so I tried to cross over the fence of the National Assembly.
What, and you climbed over the fence to get in?
Yes. I climbed over the fence and then crossed over, and then I went into the National Assembly with the help of people.
Right.
Citizens. And then some of the people helped me climb the fence of the National Assembly, and then I succeeded in coming into the National Assembly.
And he got there just in time to take part in a vote on that declaration of martial law, which produced a unanimous result, one that was announced by the Speaker of the House, Woo Won-sik.
I declare that 190 MPs were present and all 190 voted in favour of a motion demanding the lifting of emergency martial law.
After a short, uncertain period when the military insisted that it would continue to obey the president's order, President Yoon relented. Carrying out a remarkably quick and supple U-turn, he lifted the martial law declaration he had only imposed hours before.
존경하는 국민 여러분, 저는 어제 밤 11시를 기해
Dear citizens, last night, to start at 11 p.m, I declared martial law with firm resolve to save the nation. However, just a short while ago, the National Assembly demanded the lifting of martial law, and I have ordered the martial law command forces to be withdrawn. Through a cabinet meeting, I will immediately accept the National Assembly's request and lift martial law.
Well, let's go to the South Korean capital now. We can speak to Nemo Kim, a journalist who's in Seoul and is just outside the National Assembly building. Good morning to you there, Nemo. What is the scene like out the outside Parliament now?
Right. Right outside the South Korean National Assembly, there are still hundreds of people protesting. I've just been in the middle of a melee with hundreds of police officers trying to disperse the protesters. There are some violent shoving and pushing. You can probably hear a lot of police officers and protesters shouting at each other. Protesters are trying not to move away. They want to keep protesting against the President Yoon's declaration and also about the president in general here.
Yes, I mean, what is expected to happen now? He has reversed his decision, but are the protesters there saying he needs to step down?
Yes, they're most likely definitely saying that he needs to step down. Some are even calling for the president to be arrested because they feel that his declaration of martial law had no validity. It just caused severe disruptions in South Korean society. Most Koreans feel, and also most politicians, as we saw in the unanimous vote to reject the martial law, see no reason for the martial law have taken place. So, and not to mention economic and financial ramifications. The South Korean currency won, the value of it has plummeted due to this situation.
So what do you think has led to this? I mean, it's remarkable, really. I guess some South Koreans went to sleep and woke up without possibly not knowing what had happened in the interim when martial law was imposed and then lifted. But can you just explain to us why this came about?
Yeah, well, most of us are mystified as to the reason why this happened. As you said, some South Koreans went to bed and woke up to this situation. According to our constitution, the president can declare martial law during wartime or warlike situations that require the use of military force. And not many South Koreans see the situation before he imposed martial law as having required this kind of situation. So a lot of South Koreans here at first totally mystified, and now that has turned into anger.
Okay, well, look, thank you so much, Nemo, for that update. That's South Korean journalist Nemo Kim there outside the National Assembly building in Seoul, where clearly there's still a lot of anger over what has happened over the past few hours. Well, as the events of this evening unfolded in South Korea, the country's rather discombobulated allies in the West have been watching warily. The government here expressed its deep concern about what's happened, while the United States, which has 30,000 troops stationed in South Korea, spoke about its grave concern. In the past half hour, the White House has said it's relieved that President Yoon reversed that decision about martial law. Well, joining us now is Harry Harris. He was a U.S. ambassador to South Korea until 2021. Before that, he was commander of the U.S. Armed Forces in the Pacific. That includes South Korea, of course. Welcome to the program, Ambassador.
Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Well, let's put this in some kind of context. I mean, how unprecedented is this?
Well, it's unprecedented in modern times, but certainly not unprecedented in historical context. The last time martial law was declared in Korea was in 1980, when then President Chun Doo-hwan declared it after he took power in a military coup. In my view, those were the bad old days of intra-South Korean politics. Unprecedented today because the political dynamic then in 1980 was far different than the dynamic that we see in South Korea today. Today, South Korea is a vibrant liberal democracy. Case in point, one party controls the Blue House. Another party controls the legislature. Another case in point, we saw a smooth transfer of power from former President Moon to current President Yoon, and so on. South Korea today is an economic powerhouse also and a global cultural leader.
So can you try to explain to us, to our listeners, what has happened? What has led to this, do you think?
Well, my opinion is based only on what I've read in the media. I've not spoken to Washington nor anyone in Seoul. But I agree with your previous correspondence that this decision by President Yoon to take this break glass option, if you will, was made strictly because of internal political issues, not because of external or outward-facing threats. You know, clearly he's frustrated by an opposition majority of the legislature that he views stymieing his every move, including not improving the budget. But that's why they're called the opposition. It's hardly an emergency if they can't pass a budget. He's also frustrated by the National Assembly's moves to impeach almost a dozen of his cabinet members. But that's what we would call in the United States checks and balances. In my view, South Korea has been plunged needlessly into political crisis. Thankfully, President Yoon has revoked his declaration of martial law, certainly in the face of brave opposition, in my view, from the population in Korea who protested vehemently, and by the National Assembly, which voted against the martial law declaration. And we have to remember also that President Yoon's own political party leader, Han Dong-hoon, also stated that martial law is wrong and he would work to stop it.
What do you think this means for South Korea's relationship with the outside world, in particular with its allies such as the United States?
Well, I think that at this point, because the martial law has been rescinded by the president, you know, it's early days yet. Before the president, President Yoon, declared the martial law was over, my concerns were twofold. My biggest concern was that I thought the North Korea could view this as an opportunity for nefarious activity, given that the South Korea's armed forces would necessarily be internally focused on maintaining martial law.
So what, in other words, then, the specter he evoked might actually come true?
It could. And so that's why combined readiness, the U.S. ROK, Republic of Korea, military readiness against external threats must remain paramount, and they must be alert for any bad behavior from North Korea. But it also, my other concern was, it gives many in the U.S. a basis upon which to question our alliance with South Korea, including the aforementioned 30,000 or so troops that we have stationed there. We tout our alliance, rightly so, as one based on fundamental and shared democratic values. And the imposition of martial law in this specific instance would seem to many, including me, to be inconsistent with those values. Thankfully, those values rose to the foreground, and President Yoon rescinded his declaration of martial law.
Harry Harris, former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, thanks very much. Coming up later on The World Tonight.
When a black man strikes back, he's an extremist. He's supposed to sit passively and have no feelings, be nonviolent, and love his enemy, no matter what kind of attack, be it verbal or otherwise, he's supposed to take it.
60 years on from the remarkable moment when Malcolm X addressed the Oxford Union, we speak to one of the students who was there, the writer Tariq Ali. Now, from a political crisis in Asia that came out of nowhere to one in Europe that has been coming to a head for a while. Tomorrow, the National Assembly in France is expected to hold a vote of no confidence in Prime Minister Michel Barnier after he failed to convince the left and right wing blocs that make up 2/3 of an evenly divided parliament to support his austerity budget. Tonight, the Prime Minister, who was appointed by President Macron after a snap parliamentary election, failed to bring political clarity, gave a prime-time interview in which he expressed the hope that MPs wouldn't show him the door.
I think it's possible that there will be a reflex of responsibility where, beyond political differences, divergences, normal contradictions in a democracy, we say to ourselves that there is a higher interest. I think that the higher interest of the country, the common good, the national interest, that means something.
The vote of no confidence, or the vote to censure Monsieur Barnier, was called by parties on the left and the right after he had used an article of the French Constitution to force through his deficit-cutting budget. A series of concessions had failed to win over Marine Le Pen, leader of the hard-right National Rally. Well, when The World Tonight was in Paris in July for that inconclusive parliamentary election, I spoke to Jean-Claude Trichet, former governor of the Bank of France and former president of the European Central Bank, about France's spiralling deficit. He said then whoever became prime minister had no choice but to cut the deficit. The government, he added, had no room for manoeuvre. Well, I spoke to him again this evening and I asked how concerned he was about the current situation.
It is obviously very concerning. I cannot blame anybody. The situation is very, very complex. Barnier tried to do all what he could to avoid the censorship, even going very far in the concession he was making to the extreme right. And in my opinion, it was perhaps necessary from the political standpoint, but certainly not good from the, I would say, overall economic budget and fiscal standpoint. So unfortunately, despite making a lot of concession, it didn't work.
Could one not look at this as the failure of the Republican centre, if we want to call it that, to attract those on the left and the right to its programme?
To the right, they succeeded. If you put aside the extreme right, Le Pen, you have the Républicains, Les Républicains, that joined. So you cannot say that they were incapable to have some kind of negotiation, discussion.
The Prime Minister, and let's see how long he is Prime Minister for, Michel Barnier, says, I don't think the French people will forgive us for choosing party interests over the future of the country. Is that how you see what's happening at the moment?
What is absolutely clear is that the electorate, our fellow citizens, do not realize to which extent it is time to redress the situation, have the house in order, particularly on the fiscal side. And they are not aware of that. There is a propaganda which is made by the extreme right, extreme left, and unfortunately sometimes, for political reasons, accompanied even by the center, with this idea, we need more spendings in this domain, more spending there, and so forth and so forth. It's absolutely ridiculous. We are the champion of public spendings in Europe, and we should of course redress the situation.
When we spoke in July, you said there was no room for manoeuvre on public spending. The deficit had to be reduced. When you see France approaching Greek levels borrowing costs, what do you think?
All what I said 3 months ago is absolutely clear, absolutely true, and did not change in any respect. My working assumption is not that our fellow citizens will entertain the idea to go to a catastrophe.
And what about Europe more generally? What is at stake in this for Europe? If France doesn't get its house in order, what does it mean for the EU?
At a time where we had, after Lehman Brothers and the start of the abominable crisis of the sovereign risk, I had five countries that were incapable to finance themselves. We proved that the euro area was extraordinarily resilient. We had five countries which were in a dramatic situation, and at the same moment, we welcomed five new countries in the euro area, so proving not only resilience, but attractiveness. Forget about a drama in Europe.
The former president of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet. The former chief of staff of the Israeli military has accused the army of carrying out ethnic cleansing in northern Gaza. Moshe Yaalon, who's also a former defence minister, said the military was cleaning the area of Arabs. The Israel Defence Forces have rejected the claims. His remarks highlight the unease among some in Israel about the aims of the war and how it's being fought. More than 160 reserve soldiers have signed a letter refusing to serve in Gaza or threatening refusal unless there is a deal to end the war and bring Israeli hostages home from Gaza. From Jerusalem, our special correspondent Fergal Keane sent this report.
I know at least three people that were brutally murdered in the 7th of October. Israel is a small country. Everyone knows each other.
I knew that the military action was inevitable and was due and was justified in a way, but I was very worried about the shape it might take.
The voices, first of Yuval Green and then Michael Ofer Ziv, who are among more than 160 Israeli reservists who signed a letter refusing or threatening to refuse service in Gaza. Both felt it was their duty to serve after the Hamas attack on October 7th last year. But over a year into the war, both now want a ceasefire, along with the return of the hostages held by Hamas. Yuval Green was a combat medic in the paratroops. Language he heard at the outset of the war worried him deeply.
People were speaking about killing the entire population of Gaza, speaking about as if it was some type of an academic idea that makes sense. And with this atmosphere, soldiers are entering Gaza, you know, just a month after their friends were butchered.
Michael Ofer Ziv was working in a brigade operations room when he says he heard disturbing words.
I think the most horrible sentence that I heard was someone said to me that the kids that we spared on 2014, the last war in Gaza, became the terrorists of October 7th, which I bet is true for some cases, because, you know, some kids grew up to be terrorists, but definitely not all of them.
For Yuval Green, the scale of destruction he was witnessing in Gaza accelerated his questioning of how and why the war was being fought, leading him to a decisive moment.
Turning point was when they told us to burn down a house, and I went to my commander and I asked him, why are we doing that? And the answers he gave me were just not good enough, and that was my last day in Gaza.
Like the crowd at this rally in Jerusalem, the refusers who signed the letter are deeply mistrustful of the current government.
You can hear there the voice of Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's coming from a large screen and the crowd are responding with whistles, with klaxons. This is a man they definitely, definitely want to see leaving power.
I've come into a tent near the Knesset, and on the walls all around me are the faces of soldiers who've been killed in this war. This memorial here is run by a group which wants the war to go on until what they call a final victory over Hamas.
Those refusing service for reasons of conscience are a small minority, just scores out of hundreds of thousands of IDF reservists. Many more, as many as 25%, are reported to be not turning up for duty because of physical and emotional burnout. About an hour south of here, I met a reservist who's sharply critical of the refusers, accusing them of playing politics with the army. Major Sam Lipsky defends the IDF against accusations of using disproportionate force.
There's no way to fight a war and to prosecute a military campaign without these images happening. You can't mow the lawn without grass flying up. It's very tragic. And that can be true while also saying that it is completely the fault of the terrorist regime that rules the Gaza Strip.
Back at the rally in Jerusalem, they sing Israel's national anthem, the Hatikva. People here share the demands for a peace deal to bring the hostages home. For the refusers like Yuval Green and Michael Ofer Ziv, there's a worry for Israel's future, as well as hope that in the long run, Palestinians and Israelis might find a way to make peace. Yuval Green.
I think in this conflict, there are only two sides, not the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. There is the side that supports violence and the side that supports finding better solutions.
It's scarier and scarier. Every day it just looks less and less likely that I will be able, holding the values that I hold, wanting the future that I want for my kids to live here.
Michael Ofeziv ending that report by Fergal Keane in Jerusalem. As a revolutionary black nationalist from the United States, he was an icon to some and anathema to others in the audience that day. It's exactly 60 years since Malcolm X took part in the end-of-year debate at the Oxford Union. He was speaking in favour of the proposition, extremism in the defence of liberty is no vice, moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. Well, as the US civil rights movement was gathering pace, the appearance of this fiery and controversial speaker at an institution seen as the crucible of Britain's ruling establishment was quite a moment, and it was one that was broadcast to millions on BBC One that evening. One of the students who organised the debate was the left-wing writer and political activist Tariq Ali.
Malcolm, to our amazement, agreed to come to the debate. He came and made an absolutely amazing speech, got a standing ovation from a 99% white audience. And we chatted the night away that night, him and me.
Well, I want to come to that in a minute. But I mean, one of the extraordinary things about this is he came with the help of the BBC, didn't he?
The BBC broadcast that live. Someone who became a future DG of the BBC in Truthound did it for a program called Gallery.
The Oxford Union, one of the most famous debating societies in the world, nearing the end of the final debate of the university term, the farewell debate. And on his feet at this moment, Malcolm X, one of the leaders of the...
Eric Abrahams was the president of the union. I was the treasurer. It was Eric's idea. We all backed him up. It happened. And then the interesting thing is I was wearing my Pakistani dress, so to speak. And he immediately came up to me and he said, "Muslim brother," and embraced me. We were introduced and I said, "Malcolm, I hate to let you down, but I'm a staunch atheist."
And what do you remember of the debate, of his performance during that debate?
Hypnotic. He basically explained what slavery was. He explained that black people had always had to fight for their rights. He explained that despite the victory of the Union side in the American Civil War, black people were still fighting for their rights.
"But when a black man strikes back, he's an extremist. He's supposed to sit passively and have no feelings, be nonviolent, and love his enemy, no matter what kind of attack, be it verbal or otherwise, he's supposed to take it. But if he stands up and in any way tries to defend himself, then he's an extremist."
And he said, "If they use violence against us, we should use violence against them." That's how he explained it.
You described him as hypnotic. Were those on the other side of the argument, those who'd perhaps come very sceptical of him, were they also hypnotised? Were they also mesmerised?
They were mesmerised. We could see them. And after Malcolm gave his speech and received a standing ovation, I mean, all the students who sat down just kept looking at him. And he whispered in my ear, "Do you think the speech was all right?" And I said, "Just look at them."
"And I, for one, will join in with anyone, don't care what color you are, as long as you want to change this miserable condition that exists on this earth. Thank you."
I said, "It's not often you get standing ovations in this chamber." And they loved you. And that was a fact. They did. They'd never heard a speaker like Malcolm before.
And I suspect you still remember his parting words to you, because they were rather prophetic, weren't they?
They were. This was afterwards when we were talking. You know, the conversation went on. And then I said, "So I better go see you again, I hope." And he gave this sort of strange smile and said, "I hope, but I don't think we ever will." I said, "Why?" He said, "I think they're going to kill me very soon." I said, "Who's going to kill you?" "I don't know," he said. "I've made lots of enemies, the FBI, the CIA, because I attacked the American wars in Vietnam and elsewhere. or perhaps even some people from my former organization, the Nation of Islam, because I've broken with them. And they won't like this speech I made tonight, in which I preached black and white should fight together against injustice. I said, come on, man. He said, no, you don't know the United States. I do. So I hope we meet, but if we don't, we just embraced and I left.
And he did know. A couple of months later, he was assassinated.
Exactly. He did know. And I opened The Guardian, I think, the following two months later in February, and there it was on the front page. A few of us friends who'd been with me at the debate, we sort of wept and got drunk that whole day.
60 years ago today that happened. What are your reflections on it from this vantage point?
The world has changed. Oxford has changed. Britain has changed. This new generation comes out and marches and protests in a very different milieu to what existed in 1964. And more power to their elbow. Malcolm X would certainly have approved of all this.
Writer Tariq Ali, his memoir You Can't Please All is out now. The first UK TikTok Awards were held tonight, honouring the best creators on the social media app, where brevity isn't just the soul of wit, but a way to reach a huge audience, and not just for the purposes of entertainment. Before the ceremony, I spoke to two of the nominees for Education Creator of the Year, the rapping science teacher Matt Green and the history gossip Katie Kennedy. And Katie told me how her TikTok career began.
I was in my final year of uni. It was this time last year. I was doing my dissertation, sick of my life. So I decided I wanted to do something creative, but also in the history space, because that's my degree. So I just started posting videos on TikTok. But I was sort of embarrassed a little bit. So I blocked everyone that I knew at uni. I blocked my family and my friends. So I was like, this is so embarrassing, just like talking to a screen and then it's getting like one like. And then it kind of blew up in December, January, where I posted a video called Was Anne of Cleves a Minger? And then my friends were like, is that you? And I was like, no, it's not.
Was Anne of Cleves actually clapped, or was it just Henry VIII being a little bitch? Even though Henry had pissed off the church and everyone else to try and get a male heir, he was still being really picky about finding another wife. And he hated altered portraits. Even though he looked like this, and this is like a good day. Even though Henry was crying about women like photoshopping their portraits, he was distributing portraits of him as a much younger man. And this is where it gets a bit dodge.
So tell us a little bit about your approach. How do you go about deciding what to do?
It really depends. Sometimes it's just questions that I want to know. Like I did one last week, how did people wake up before alarm clocks? Why did the Tudors have disgusting teeth? Things that interest the normal people. Because I feel like sometimes in school, you learn the same things you learn about the date, you learn about wars and what happened in politics. I feel like when you're asking personal questions like that, it really humanizes history. I feel it's so important to make sure that you're looking at credible sources. You're not just going on Wikipedia and reading it off a page.
What about you, Matt? You're at a slightly different stage in your career. How did you start making these TikToks?
Well, I started just trying to find a new way of teaching students. I was a classroom teacher, I think about 4 or 5 years ago. I thought, what's the new method I could use to help kids learn? And then I heard a car playing a song and I knew the lyrics to it. It was a very popular song at the time based on the Million Dollar Baby track. I made a parody of that and that went flying, talking about the structure of lungs, but in about 1 minute rather than 50 minutes.
This is the trachea right here. It takes in oxygen down into the bronchi. It moves in, fills up alveoli. Diffusion. We use both these for taking a breath. Oxygen in and I say this with chest. Carbon dioxide required to leave.
It was interesting hearing Katie's scenario because I didn't keep it in private, but no one watched it at the beginning. And then 6 months later, I've made a little change to one of my formats and it just went viral. I went from 0 to 20,000 followers and it's just hitting a million on TikTok now.
What do the kids make of it? What do your students make of it?
Luckily, no one saw when I was getting 0 followers and 0 views. But the second it blew up, people were like, oh my God, sir, you're TikTok famous. So they loved it and they were asking me to rap in school.
Matt's videos have clearly had an impact on students. But what kind of impact do you sense yours are having, Katie?
I usually get comments on my videos being like, oh, I've decided to choose GCSE history because of you, or I'm doing A-level, or I've had a few messages being like, I'm thinking about studying at uni. Can you tell me what your experience was like? It's so rewarding to have those comments above everything else. My videos, they're quite humorous and they're a bit satirical, but if someone can take a fact from that. If they've been scrolling for hours and they can take a fact from one of my videos, I feel like I've done my job. So yeah.
Do you think more traditional history teachers are perhaps having a look at what you're doing and thinking, maybe we need to get a bit of this as well?
I have had a few teachers being like, I've played your videos in class, and I'm like, oh my goodness, like which ones? Because some of them are quite sweary. these subjects, they are fun and easy to learn. It's just the way in which kids are wanting to learn. They want like bite-sized pieces of information now, and that's why I feel like TikTok works so well.
And Matt, your science videos, they range pretty far and wide, don't they?
It's for GCSE students, chemistry, biology and physics. Get thousands of messages from students talking about they were getting grade threes before. They now have used the videos and they now started on fives and now I'm getting eights. So I got eights and nines. So yeah, it's always humbling. It's always amazing to see. And this keeps me doing it. I enjoy the process of making the raps, but when I know they're making a difference, it makes it worth it.
When I was in school, I used to come last. Took me 10 years till I gained some heart. As we're on heart, now that's where we'll start. Let's dive right in, I'll tear it apart. Four chain
buses, look at them all. You've both been very successful, and these videos are clearly doing well amongst younger people, amongst teenagers. And I wanted to ask you both, because there's quite a debate at the moment about social media and whether it should perhaps not be allowed for younger teenagers to have access to it. We've seen Australia pass its law, under 16s no longer having access to social media. What are your thoughts on that debate, Katie?
I feel like kids are still going to find a way to use it. I feel like social media is very powerful, especially if you're using it to learn things like what me and Matt are doing. We're using it to reach out to kids who might not necessarily learn in the best way in a traditional classroom format, but they can learn things from our videos.
Matt, what's your thought?
There are so many kids out there that struggle, especially with subjects like history and science, that either don't like it or they just find it difficult to understand. And they could be on social media one day scrolling whatever nonsense they look at, and then suddenly they see a history video come up about some historical figure that was a flamingo. I'm like, oh, that gets their attention. And now they suddenly get it. Or they see a science topic that's in a rap form in 30 seconds and they now understand it. If that was banned, they miss out on that completely. One of the benefits of us creators like myself and Katie is that we hone our trade at explaining things in very short form. That's a benefit to teaching, getting information across as quickly as humanly possible.
Yeah, and that is an art from sort of personal experience. You're actually distilling something to its basics is not an easy thing to do.
If you can hook someone and then get them in and then teach them something, a fact, yeah, I definitely think it's the way forward, because as Matt said, like, it will take half an hour to an hour to explain something in the classroom. People are switching off, they're talking to their friends, they're doodling, they're going on the phones or whatnot. But if you can condense it into something that's easy to remember, whether it's a rap, a song, or I think that's the way forward, and that's how people are learning and how it's sticking.
Katie Kennedy, who runs, as she put it, the sometimes sweary, the history gossip, and Matt Green, the rapping science teacher. Just time for a TikTok length goodbye. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamarasamy. I'm back at 10 tomorrow. But for now, from me and everyone here, good night.